youth. Some of it's a long time ago. Some of you not so long ago. But I remember the turmoil and tumult of early manhood. Some of you won't remember that. And no doubt the equivalent of womanhood. But the awful identity incomprehension of that period. I suppose I felt it particularly sharply because I was bred to serve the empire. And unfortunately, the empire, or fortunately, the empire had got lost. So who was I? What was I? And of course, the great big question, girls. I remember that tumult, you know, my late teens and early 20s, carrying on to my 60s, no, that sort of tumult of youth. Speaking from the wintry end of the autumn of my life, I wouldn't go back to that spring. It was, for me, and I'm sure not for everybody, a very painful and confusing time. But I remember in that time, periods of solace, of really powerful solace, mediated mainly by music, although other arts also could have that effect. I remember especially the music of Bach, the orchestral suites, to begin with, that stately brassiness and the solemn majesty and the sweetness of the dance themes that ran through the suites. Such beautiful music, and it would just carry me out of myself, as we say. I would leave behind that turmoil, the turmoil of I was going to say adolescence, I'm afraid it was a very late adolescence, as was appropriate to the times. But I'd just be completely lifted out of it and forget all about it. And it would sometimes last for hours, even days. I'd be left with that mood of release and of a freedom from all the turmoil and tumult. I remember it with film as well. I remember particularly in a very painful period of jealousy and loneliness, isolation, going to see Solaris by the great Tarkovsky, the Rembrandt, Shakespeare and Bach of film. Extraordinary film. Not his greatest film, but a very great film indeed. And I didn't really understand what I was watching. I didn't really follow it, as it were. You know, there's a narrative, but I couldn't see what was going on in the film. But I remember coming out of the film a changed man. And remaining changed for weeks, that the feeling of the film just echoing inside me, you know, particularly the image of the planet Solaris, with its very powerful influence, which I'm not going to explore the image. It's another story, but extraordinary effect upon me, releasing me from this tumult of pain and confusion. I remember my first encounter with painting. Of course, I'd seen paintings before, but I went with Marici to, she wasn't Marici then, and I wasn't Sabuti then. We went to Italy together, and we travelled around, and of course, found ourselves in Florence. And I didn't really know what had happened to me. I just saw a lot of paintings. I can't even remember specifically looking at any painting. But I remember that after a day or two, I realised I was intensely happy. I was just full of all that colour, that rich, pure colour that especially the early Renaissance is so wonderful for. Fra Angelico had a powerful effect upon me. And of course, then the Botticellis and so forth. I didn't understand them. I didn't know how to look at them. I know now their flaws. I know now that there are better painters. But they had an enormous effect upon me in terms of my experience of myself. So it's that I'm wanting to explore today. The way in which an encounter with an aesthetic object changes you. You are a different person as a consequence of that encounter. Of course, there are different ways in which that change can take place. I used to listen to a lot of music, a lot of different music, some of which had the same effect upon me, whether rock and roll or folk or whatever. What do they call it? Psychedelic music, which I was very, very fond of, which occasionally could have that same effect, at least to some degree. Not quite the same degree and not with such purity. But quite often, I'd basically have an image of myself as Mick Jagger having an image of himself as the devil, if you see what I mean. I'd sort of be taken in by his bad boy image rather than the charming old buffer he is today. I'd be sort of carried away with these images that the music would induce, these alternative selves, alternative constructions of self, or, the lover, or I'd feel that Carole King was singing to me, and so on. So music could have that effect, a sort of escapist effect, because I'd identify with the image that the music itself was purveying. And for a while I'd be released from my particular self and I'd occupy another self that was, at least to me at that time, seemed more attractive and adequate and what we ought to be. This sort of release from self is not necessarily a very constructive thing. Can be a release from self into a fantasy self. And I think that quite often that was the case for me. And I think that's quite often the case for many people. Music and art in general, can release you into a sort of fantasy self so that you come out feeling that you're, a gunslinger or that you're... the hero who saved the day, whatever it is, you sort of identify with the image that's being purveyed by the art so-called, let's say. The escape from your ordinary identity can be merely an escape into an alternative, fantastical identity, which is actually even more inadequate than the one that you're escaping from. I think there can be another danger, which is that you simply go into this sort of alternative self, this even, I would say, higher self, and simply sort of hide in it. I think this is the problem of aestheticism, that you are released from the burden of everyday pressure, but you're not made better by it. You simply... sort of enjoy it for a while, even for quite a long while. There's a very famous incident, isn't there, when after the first performance of The Messiah, when Handel came out after the performance and was met by, I think it was the Duke of Chandos, I can't remember, but anyway, an art-loving duke, who strode up to him, clapped him on the back and said, "Damn fine music, Handel, damn good entertainment." So Handel, who was an irascible old fellow, turned around and said, "I wrote it not to entertain you, but to make you better." Excuse my bad German accent. I said it just to entertain you. I hope it makes you better. But that's the point. He wrote it not just for a temporary relief so that you spread all over the universe, alleluia, 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 but that you have a different experience of yourself and a different experience of life, and that you come out a better person. So I think that there are these two alternative diversions from the power of art to transform you. One is the transformation of of yourself in terms of a fantasy self. I think this is why the concentration camp guards in the Third Reich were supposed to often be great lovers of music, especially, of course, German Aryan music. I imagine that what they sort of felt while the music was going, you know, they'd hear Beethoven. There is a bombastic edge in a lot of Beethoven. They would sort of puff themselves up with a sort of sense of their Aryan superiority, which I don't think is what Beethoven mainly meant at all. But yes, you can be sort of taken over by the image of the music, because the music, especially, is multivalent. It has no inherent meaning. Yes, and you can just wallow in art, especially if you've got a lot of money. You can just surround yourself with beautiful things. This is what La Grande Bellezza is about, by the way. You can surround yourself with beautiful things and experience a sort of beautiful self, but without really transforming yourself. But the power of art, at its best, is to release you from your empirical experience of yourself, your empirical idea of yourself, and give you a glimpse of yourself in a far more essential, pure way. So that for a little while, you experience yourself outside time. Just as the aesthetic object is released for a while from the constrictions of space, time, and causality, to put it like that, so that you experience just the pure image. For a little while, art of any kind can liberate you from the trammels of the empirical self, the empirical character, your empirical experience of yourself, to a much purer, much more fine, much more subtle experience of yourself. It's quite difficult to talk about this because, of course, it immediately challenges our ideas about not-self. And I'm going to talk much more about that tomorrow because, of course, we can't dispense with the not-self doctrine. But I do think quite often when we talk about not-self, we haven't really grasped what self is, and that we are not really experiencing fully enough and deeply enough the subtlety and depth of selfhood. Self as something not merely to do with space and time, but something that kind of is given in experience, something that experience is formed upon. It's something I want to say quite a lot about, but I don't know that I've got my thoughts straight yet, and I don't know that I haven't been able to sort of to get my thoughts in some kind of order. But please forgive me if what I say is problematic from this point of view or that point of view. Realise I'm trying to talk in the language of as if, not of philosophy or logic or anything like that. I'm trying to suggest something about our experience of ourselves in the context of art, and of course in the context of meditation too, and in other contexts as well, that I think is quite important, and that requires us to acknowledge and recognise before we can go beyond it, before we can see more widely, more broadly. Bhante's spoken about this very powerfully, and I mentioned this in the last set of talks, in terms of the idea, the sort of image, the metaphor of a gestalt of you, a whole of you that exists outside time, and that your life is an attempt to work out, that unfolds in time but exists outside time. He gave the metaphor or gave the reference to Mozart's experience of composition. It's said that Mozart, I haven't read this myself, but I've heard this from a number of sources, that Mozart said that when he composed a piece of music, first of all, he experienced that piece of music whole, not with the opening bars and then the coda. He experienced the whole thing in a single moment outside time. And that the writing down of the music or the playing of the music was simply trying to bring into the constrictures of space-time causality something that existed outside it. In a humble sort of way, that's what's happening with a talk like this one. Every morning, I've got something that I want to say. In a way, it's not anything in particular, or rather, it's not something that with a particular set of words or a particular form of words. It's not quite a feeling, because feeling suggests something merely emotional. It's difficult to exactly describe what it is. I've got something that I want to say, but what it is, I can't quite get hold of. Until my mouth is open and my tongue is wagging, I don't have any approach to what it is, and even after then I may not. So what Bhante's suggesting is, that's us. There's a sense in which we exist outside time, and that our lives are an attempt to work out. In that sense, thinking of my 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old self and all its agonies, when I was listening to Bach, when I was listening to the violin Partita number 2, which for me is one of the greatest pieces of music ever written, I'm just the same as I am now when I'm listening to that music. When I'm in that, in connection with that self outside time, think I'm becoming a Hindu, Maitreya Nagarjuna, relax. Not talking Atman here, I'm talking as if. When I'm in touch with that dimension, that subjective correlate of the objective aesthetic image, I am the same as I was then. I remember at the time, back then, so difficult to remember, and of course one's looking with the knowledge of now back on that time, but I remember then being appalled at the discrepancy of my experience of myself in the midst of music or in the midst of art and my experience of myself in the midst of life. There's an appalling contradiction which shocked and horrified me, and was sort of disillusioned, disappointed, made me disgusted with myself. I had this sort of experience of myself, and then I had another experience of myself. Then I had an experience of other people's experience of me, which is even more horrifying and shocking. I'm used to it now. Don't worry, I'm quite used to it. But you feel this sort of discrepancy between you on a level outside time, you on the level of time, and other people's experience of you in time. And they don't all match up. Fortunately, they're very much closer together now than they were when I was 20. They're still apart. You know, the experience of, you especially get this in meditation, don't you? You've been, you know, identifying yourself totally with Manjushri or Tara or something like that. And within a few seconds of completing the practice, you're just you. Plain old you. Or worse. But this experience of yourself outside time, if I said idealized self, unfortunately we've now got a polemic against idealization, and I don't want to play to that. I don't mean idealized in the sense of unreal. I mean more, maybe the best word would be the image of self. Just as the aesthetic object increasingly, as you become more and more aesthetically entranced, reveals the image that is beyond time and that is beyond its mere association with other objects. There's the same with yourself. You experience yourself as an image, the image of self. And I use image because I think it's a better way of talking than ideal because of its unfortunate ramifications. But we are an image. We live out an image. I don't mean an image in the shallow sense of believing that you're the devil for whom everybody should have sympathy, in the Jagerian sense. I mean an image in a much more subtle and exalted sense. I mean image in the sense of existing beyond the bounds of time and of temporal relations, of causal relations. Either you get what I'm talking about or you don't. I don't know that I can get any closer than that. So please, if you do find it difficult to associate with, please realise I am talking as if. And tomorrow I will, I hope, release us from any lingering wonderings about the Subhuti's going off to a Hindu guru or anything like that. I'm not talking Advaita Vedanta or something like that. I'm talking on the level of our actual aesthetic experience. You come into relationship with the aesthetic object, and as you deepen your experience of that aesthetic object, it's released from the bounds of time. It's released from the network of associations and connections and conditions, and it becomes a pure image which stands intermediate between the sensory world and reality itself, you could even say, not to put too fine a point upon it. It's the same with you. That when you enter into an association with the aesthetic object, you yourself become an image. When the object increasingly becomes an image, that is, experienced free from the bounds of time, free from the bounds of its networked connections, you too become like that. It's not anything very fancy, do you know what I mean? It's not suddenly that you grow wings and all that, just as it's not that the object actually changes if you're talking about a physical object. The physical object is still a physical object, but your experience of it comes closer and closer to the image which it is. And your experience of yourself comes closer and closer to the image that you are. It's a very powerful and very satisfying experience. It's satisfying, first of all, because it's a relief from the turmoil, the turbulence, and the brutal unsatisfactoriness of ordinary life, even in its temporary reliefs of pleasure and achievement and so forth. Even when the worldly winds are blowing with you, you've got half an ear out for the whistle of the other worldly winds. So it's a relief from those worldly winds blowing you backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. A relief from the struggle to confirm and identify yourself, make yourself secure, clarify yourself, try to interact with the world in a way that doesn't just blow back in your face like throwing dirty water in the wind on a yacht. A way of experiencing yourself that is free from all that. So it's an intense relief. And I've certainly experienced times when aesthetic experience has sort of just whisked me out of quite intense suffering and trouble. I remember going down after the infamous Guardian article, as if there were no other articles ever published by the Guardian. We just say the Guardian article, and everybody knows exactly what we mean. Vishvapani sent me like a lamb to slaughter to a round table discussion at the World Service with the writer of the article, the other side of the table. I really did know what it was like to be a condemned man. I even had a hearty breakfast. I just kept thinking, I didn't know how I was going to deal with it. I had no way of dealing with what I knew I was going to get. I didn't know how I could, as it were, defend myself, defend Bante, defend the order. I know how I'd do it now, but then I didn't know. I'd not really got an answer. And all I thought I could do was survive, which I just about did. But as I was walking up and down, I was by Waterloo Bridge near Bush House, and I remember just sort of walking over Waterloo Bridge, and suddenly the grey swirling waters scummed with all sorts of flotsam and jetsam seemed deeply attractive. I've never had suicidal tendencies, but I did sort of at least theoretically contemplate the moment. I did think to myself, I wouldn't be that unhappy if things didn't go on from this point. And as I was looking down into those swirling waters, I suddenly became entranced by the eddies, by the way in which the water, as it passed under the bridge, through the piles on which the bridge stood, were broken and curled out. And I just stood gazing down at them. And for a few moments, I was released from this impossible, conflicted situation that I was walking into. And then it all came back and I had to go in and do it. But it's moments like that when you're suddenly released, and I did know that it was all right. It was all okay. Whatever happened, it was okay. I was okay. There was something in me, something to me, that was beyond all that mess, in which I had no way of satisfactorily dealing apart from trying to remain cool and firm at some points. That's all I could do. But I knew that I was all right. Even if I made a mess, I was okay. Even if it was a mess, I was okay. I glimpsed myself outside time, outside this particularity of circumstance and situation. I'd experienced for a moment in watching those eddies curling under the bridge, I'd experienced the image of myself, an image of myself that came closer to the reality of things than my empirical situation suggested. So art can throw us into that experience of ourselves detached to a greater or lesser extent from the trammels of our empirical self and all its confusions. It can throw us beyond the identity that craves, the identity that hates, the identity that ignores the uncomfortable facts. It can throw us beyond all that so that we're freed, we're uncontaminated. We experience ourselves pure in that sense as uncontaminated. And we experience ourselves sort of undistorted, naked. That's why I don't like to confuse this with, this language of ideal, because that ideal becomes associated with idealism, and apparently we're not supposed to be idealistic. It's not that sort of ideal as opposed to real. It's a more real experience of yourself, which includes the whole of you. But the whole of you prior to your involvement in evil and in pleasure and in transitory self-delusions. Yourself, as it were, above and beyond all that, or below and beneath all that, however you want to metaphoricalise it. That is what art can bring us to. We don't usually notice it because our attention is on the object. And that's the point of art, isn't it? That it presents us with an object which entrances us and that draws us into it and that is so pleasing, so pleasurable, that we want to go deeper and deeper into it. And in the course of that entrancement, the glamour of that object, in the true sense of its magical power to draw us in, we lose ourselves. That is, we lose our ordinary self. But we have a truer, a finer experience of ourselves. And if we are practicing the Dhamma in a broader way, if we're practicing ethics, if we're practicing meditation, if we're studying the Dhamma, that purer experience of ourselves can flow into all our experience. It's contextualized, so it doesn't become mere aestheticism that allows one some relief to just go on being a thoroughly ordinary, perhaps not very good person, tasting a little bit of pleasure from time to time, maybe of an even rather gross kind, perhaps even very subtle kind, like Jep Gambardella in La Grande Bellezza. If we have that context of ethics, if we have that context of active pursuit of more skillful, more positive mental states, if we have that perspective of clarity in the Dhamma, the self that we experience in art, the image of ourselves that we experience in art, can be a fuel to our practice, fuel to our lives. In a way, I'd say that Bach made me an order member. I'd say that Tarkovsky made me an order member. In my experience of myself in listening to Bach's music, Shakespeare's plays I could mention, Rembrandt's paintings, you look at a Rembrandt painting and you know what a genuine, authentic self is, especially the self-portraits, of course, where you see he's prepared to look at himself nakedly, but with deep, deep love. And when you listen and watch and hear and read these very great artists, you experience yourself in a deeper way, a higher way, a purer way, an image of yourself, an image of yourself which is what your whole life is, in an untidy, inefficient, often mistaken, often even backwards way, trying to explore, trying to work out, trying to give body to embody. You're trying to give form to this inchoate experience of yourself outside time. And we make such a mess of it. We try this, we try that. I remember before I became a Buddhist, trying on so many postures which seemed to work out what I'd experienced through these encounters with great art, and even not so great art, this experience of myself, which was above and beyond my ordinary experience of myself, trying to find a way to live it out, failing again and again, going up blind alleys, too crude, too simplistic, too self-infatuated, too deluded, and too influenced by other people's opinions of me and their half-baked ideas about life, stumbling around, but so much trying to work out this image. Most people never get round to it, poor people. Well, they only get round to it in small ways. But through my encounter with the Dhamma, I began to experience a way of living out that image of myself that I know is more who I am than who I am. And especially through my encounter with Bhante, who to me seems to be closely in contact with the image of himself, even if perhaps not always does that image get tidily expressed, even in his case. You seem deeply in contact with that image and to recognize it in me. Recognize it in me in the way that he related to me, the way that he communicated with me. And I was deeply impressed by his powerful connection to and response to the great arts. And I remember that the very first time I heard him speak after a meditation class in which I had the deepest dhyana I had for 40 years. Beginner's luck, if ever there was one. Afterwards, a question and answers. And what really impressed me was when Bhante was speaking about literature, and poetry, and art, and connecting it with, not connecting it with, but speaking of it in the context of the Dhamma. I knew I'd found my teacher, although I didn't know it at the time. So, I hope that you've got some flavour of what I'm talking about, even if I haven't given a particularly clear conceptual framework for it. Or rather, even if my conceptual framework is all too clear and therefore all too graspable, if you see what I mean, and therefore all too falsifiable. But I hope you've got some flavour of this experience of oneself, this different experience of oneself, which is rich, full, satisfying, enjoyable, yes, fulfilling, and that can be, if it's contextualized by the practice and teaching of the Dhamma in connection with a community, a spiritual community, and with teacher and teachers, it can mean that one is able more and more to embody the image of oneself to its fullest possible extent, and eventually even to go beyond it. But that is another story.